Disclaimer: the views and opinions expressed in Radio DMG may or may not be the views and opinions of the DMGI's family of sites. All music used in this podcast is the property of whoever made it, and no copyright infringement is intended. God bless this albatross, and hold on tight for the awesome you're about to receive.
It's good to be the king.
Wait, that's not right. God, I'm gonna have to fire some people. That's the stuff. Okay, hey, okay. Fade it out. Good. Okay, there we go. Welcome to this edition of Radio DMG. I think this is episode... Let me check real quick on that. What episode are we at? Well, I do know that it is August 2nd, 2011. I am your host, Philip Wesley, the Mile High Mouth. And you're listening to Radio DMG, episode number... Well, you know, I should have this with me. Really, I really should keep track of that. But, Well, you're listening to Radio DMG, episode number 17. And today, we've got just a little bit of newsity, nothing really important. And then an interview with Monty Uem of Dead Fantasy fame. The interview has to do, well, Monty Uem. Well, he introduces kind of himself in the thing. So if you're a fan of Dead Fantasy, if you're watching that on game trailers, highly anticipating like episode 6 of it, or if you like Rooster Teeth, if you're watching, what was that name of that? Was that Red versus Blue? And you're looking forward to season 9 or so, yeah, this is an interview for you. It actually kind of complements, because Dead or Alive is something, Dead Fantasy uses Dead or Alive characters versus Final Fantasy characters. So this kind of concludes the trilogy of interviews that began with Vanessa Ortega, Team Ninja, and Monty Uem. That's a trilogy, a trifecta of interviews, all somehow related to Dead or Alive. It's also kind of has to do with Tekken. And before I get into the newsity, I guess I'll go mention that I saw the new Tekken movie that will be included with Tekken Hybrid. Now, the Tekken movie is Tekken Blood Resurrection in 3D, three-dimensional. Now, it's going to be included as part of Tekken Hybrid, which will have Tekken Blood Resurrection. It's a 3D CGI movie from the people who put together Resident Evil Degeneration. And that's one part of the hybrid thing. The other part of the hybrid thing is a PlayStation 3 port of Tekken Tag Tournament, but in HD. So, well, that's not completely, and that's not really portable related. It's animation related. I think that Tekken Hybrid would be definitely worth it. I mean, Tekken Tag Tournament is one of the only Tekken games that I thought was worth a damn. It's pretty decent. I like it. It's my favorite out of them. Now, a little bit of word of advice on Blood Resurrection. Blood Resurrection's story is a horrifying mess, just like Tekken. But that horrifying mess is so over the top. What and wonderful because of it. I went into Blood Resurrection expecting not to be, I don't expect to be mentally stimulated by a video game movie anymore. I mean, it's kind of sad, really, when you think about it. I don't expect to go out of it thinking like, wow, that was an amazing movie and it's great. It's not the King's Speech. It's not like, say, True Grit, or, let's see, hell, I don't think any of these video game movies are really all that, thought-provoking. We never really get any that are. But, you know what? I'm fine with that. With Blood Resurrection, I liked all the characters. I thought some of the lines were a bit cheesy and over the top. The fight scenes were awesome. I felt the 3D didn't really add too much to it because of the nature of the glasses. Gah. Now, why is it that stuff can run at like 30 to 60 frames per second on the 3DS and be fine, but not so much on a large screen with glasses, shutter glasses? It's weird how that works. But my take on it is that it wasn't really worth seeing in 3D. I kind of wish it were 2D because I would have had more fun with it then. Because, like, you know, it'd be a little bit clearer in spots and not as dark. That said, the fight scenes are awesome. There's like a, I guess I could spoiler this. Well, not really. Well, there's this big fight with Jin and his dad where they're both all, they both kind of go Guyver on each other. You know, Guyver, like, turning to big devil-looking thingies with horns and stuff, and it's pretty great. And then the dude with the crazy hair, Haichi or something like that. Sounds like that dog that sits over in Shibuya or something. But anyways, Haichi, hair dude. Hair dude, at one point, uses a huge bunch of these little wood dudes. Forgot what their names are. The Mokujin. He controls like this huge Goliath of those things trying to kill Jin. And then there's like this robot girl that's in there that's like awesome. The whole movie is just a silly, ridiculous little thing. Go in, tune, that's like turn it on, tune out. Yeah, I mean, it's a movie David Leary would love, but, I thought it was fun. I thought it was a lot more fun than the Gantz movie that we saw, the live-action one. It was a lot more fun than a lot of video game movies have been. And even movies that look kind of video game-ish, like Sucker Punch or Skyline or Battle LA. Some of them take themselves way too damn seriously. And Tekken Blood Resurrection doesn't do that. So, thankfully, we got a really fun little movie. It's people been criticizing it because of the plot being silly and the character lines being cheesy, but really, come on, this is a fun movie. And yes, at some point, one of the main characters is like hanging out with the robot girl, and she's like laying on her lap. She's like, "You remind me of a refrigerator." You know, that little white noise hum, and it's kind of warm. And then later on, that same robot character at some point says, "As your refrigerator, I will do my best." I mean, seriously. "As your refrigerator, I will do my best." How can you not love a line as cheesy as that? Wonderful. Overall, if you're picking up Tekken Hybrid, you're picking it up to play Tekken Tag Tournament HD. But this is just icing on the cake that is Tekken Tag Tournament HD. So, yeah, at some point, pick that up if you own a PS3. But if you're one of those people who owns a better console, like the 3DS. Nah. Actually, if you're a 3DS owner right now, Nintendo kind of dropped a bombshell. But we'll get into that in the newsity. So, let's get the right theme this time, guys, okay? Good. Can't really snap into this. All those stupid little blue viri, sometimes they mess up the sound stuff. But yeah, let's go ahead and cue the newsity theme, and I'll get right on down to it and my opinions on that crazy event that happened recently with Nintendo. And welcome back to Radio DMG. I am your host, Philip Wesley, the Mile High Mouth, and here we are with the newsity. So, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, humans and ponies, the Nintendo 3DS had quite a rocky launch. However, Nintendo has decided to rectify this by announcing on July 28th, 2011, an interesting bit of news. Now, the Nintendo 3DS, when it launched in, I think it was March, about 4 months ago. Yeah, March, April, May, June, July. Yeah. The Nintendo 3DS launched at $249.99 with 19 games, which is actually more than the DS launched with, and more than the GameCube launched with. However, it's been kind of a little difficult for people to adopt the system into their happy homes. The reason for this may have to do with the $250 price tag and the lack of, or rather delay of, AAA titles. Now, I don't blame Nintendo for these, because they priced it according to retailer demand, retailer pressure, and the amount of hype that they had built up for the system. They figured, this is a premium product, we can put a premium price. I originally thought they were going to launch it at $230, because that's fair enough for both them to make a product profit and for retailers and everyone involved to make a profit. However, they haven't been exactly flying off the shelves. You see, in the United States of America, rather the Northern Hemisphere, I guess you could say North America, the Nintendo 3DS sold about 800,000 units. They hadn't even broken a million at the end of, I think it was like the end of June. They hadn't even broken a million units sold. That's kind of a bit of a problem, especially considering that, well, times are tough. We have lots of horrifyingly reckless economic policies coming out of the United States. And considering that the U.S. dollar is where a lot of exchange rates are based, it's been hurting everybody. There was also that earthquake that hit Japan that literally knocked a whole bunch of things into delay and lowered the amount of manpower that was available for game companies to use. So 3DS stuff got pushed to the back burner, whereas stuff for established systems like the PS3, Wii, and the PSP, and the DS were pushed ahead. Now, that's all very understandable. To combat this, Nintendo announced on July 28th that they're dropping the price of the Nintendo 3DS. Here, let me go ahead and just read you the press release for this. Nintendo 3DS price drops to $169 as great value and new 3D games come together. Star Fox 64 3D, Super Mario 3D Land, Mario Kart 7, and Kid Icarus Uprising prep Nintendo 3DS for a strong holiday season. Redmond, Washington, July 28, 2011. Nintendo of America announced today announced plans to drop the suggested retail price of its portable Nintendo 3DS system to $169 in the United States. As new games based on some of the world's most beloved video game franchises head to the system, the new price, down from the suggested launch price at $249.99 and effective August 12th, makes an outstanding value even better and sets up a strong holiday season for the system. For anyone who is on the fence about buying a Nintendo 3DS, this is a huge motivation to buy now, said Nintendo of America President Reggie Filsami. We are giving shoppers every incentive to pick up a Nintendo 3DS, from an amazing new price to a rapid-fire succession of great games. Nintendo 3DS has the strongest software lineup of any video game system this holiday season, and the new price drop now opens up the glasses-free 3D experience to many more consumers. Building on the popularity of The Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time 3D, which launched June 19th, the upcoming game calendar is a who's who of iconic video game franchises. Star Fox 64 3D arrives on September 9th, followed by Super Mario 3D Land in November, Mario Kart 7 in December, and Kid Icarus Uprising during the holiday season. Editor's note, probably in December. In addition to these great games, the Nintendo 3DS is a host of attractive features that make it the must-have video game system this season. The new Nintendo Video Service automatically delivers
short 3D videos from the worlds of music, comedy, animation, and Hollywood. A free application allows Netflix members with unlimited streaming plans to instantly watch TV episodes and movies streaming from Netflix. The Nintendo eShop is a digital store for Nintendo 3DS owners that provides access to a wide variety of downloadable content, such as original 3D software, classic games that have been remastered in 3D called 3D Classics, Game Boy and Game Boy Color virtual console games in their original 2D glory, and more than 350 Nintendo DSiWare games. Visitors can also view video game trailers, screenshots, and product information for games, including those available at retail locations. Since Nintendo 3DS launched in the United States on March 27th, more than 830,000 people in the U.S. alone have purchased one to enjoy 3D visuals without the need for special glasses. These Nintendo 3DS owners represent some of Nintendo's most loyal and, editors know, hardcore customers, and Nintendo is rewarding them for getting in on the action early with 20 free downloadable games from the Nintendo eShop. These free games are available to anyone who owns a Nintendo 3DS system and uses a wireless broadband internet signal to connect to the Nintendo 3DS eShop at least once before 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time on August 11th. These users will automatically be registered in the Nintendo 3DS Ambassador Program. The program contains two elements. Starting September 1st, Nintendo 3DS Ambassadors will be able to download 10 NES Virtual Console games at no charge and before they are available in the Nintendo eShop to the general public. These games, including Super Mario Bros., Donkey Kong Jr., Balloon Fight, Ice Climber, and The Legend of Zelda, are slated to become paid downloadable games, but Ambassadors get them early for free. Once the paid versions of the games are posted to the Nintendo eShop later in the year, the updated versions will be available to Ambassadors for download at no cost. Editor's note. What they're adding with the update when they come out as paid games is multiplayer and save states. So they're using Ambassadors as beta testers. Number two, by the end of 2011, Nintendo will provide Ambassadors with 10 Game Boy Advance Virtual Console games, editor's note, free of charge. These include games like Yoshi's Island Super Mario Advance 3, Mario Kart Super Circuit, Metroid Fusion, WarioWare Incorporated Mega Micro Games, and Mario vs. Donkey Kong. These games will be available exclusively to Ambassadors, and Nintendo has no plans to make these 10 games available to the general public on the Nintendo 3DS in the future. Editor's note, by future, they mean probably E3 2012. More details about this program will be announced in the future. Remember that Nintendo 3DS features parental controls that let parents manage the content their children can access. For more information about this and other features, visit http://www.nintendo.com/3ds. Asterisk, some features require a broadband internet connection. And there's a little bit right here at the bottom that they include at the end of one of these press releases. I'm going to try and read it to you in one breath. Hold on a second. About Nintendo. The worldwide pioneer in the creation of interactive entertainment, Nintendo Co. Ltd. of Kyoto, Japan, manufactures and markets hardware and software for its Wii home console, Nintendo 3DS, and Nintendo DS family of portable systems. Since 1983, when it launched the Nintendo Entertainment System, Nintendo has sold more than 3.7 billion video games and more than 600 million hardware units globally, including the current generation Wii, Nintendo 3DS, Nintendo DS, Nintendo DSi, Nintendo DSi XL, as well as the Game Boy, Game Boy Advance, Super NES, Nintendo 64, and Nintendo GameCube systems. It has also created the industry icons that have become well-known household names such as Mario, Donkey Kong, Metroid, Zelda, and Pokemon. A wholly owned subsidiary, Nintendo of America Incorporated, based in Redmond, Washington, serves as headquarters for Nintendo's operations in the Western Hemisphere. For more information about Nintendo, please visit the company's website at http://www.nintendo.com. And there you go. Along with this information, Nintendo of Japan announced that prominent people in the company would be taking pay cuts because of the perceived botched lineup. You see, Japan has an honor system with their businesses. For example, when the Virtual Boy failed, Gunpei Yokoi was forced to leave the company. After the Virtual Boy failed and the N64 failed to launch as hard as they expected, As when it failed to make the impact, Gunpei Yokoi had to leave. They forced people out of the business for that type of thing. Now, everyone who was involved with it, like Satoru Iwata, took a Satoru Iwata took a 50% pay cut. Shigeru Miyamoto took a 30% pay cut, as well as a couple of the other managers for the 3DS brand took pay cuts. They didn't say how deep it went, but apparently, like, a lot of people took pay cuts. Now, I know people are like, well, Satoru Iwata is pretty rich. I mean, doesn't he have all that Nintendo stock? He should be fine. Here's the deal. Stock doesn't do jack squat for you unless you sell it. Now, it's money that you've invested, but you don't own that money. When you buy stock in a company, you own a piece of paper that says that you own stock in that company. That piece of paper has no actual value except for a perceived value upon sale. In other words, you could cash it in for that money or sell it for that money, but that sale, that money amount fluctuates. So no, stock options do not equal rich. So people who've said that, that's not true. Now, I know people are like, oh no, this is the death knell for the 3DS. Oh, the world is doomed. I feel so ripped off, blah, 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 blah. Shut the hell up. Seriously? Here's the deal. The reason Nintendo is dropping this price is because the market demands it. There are many extenuating factors aside from a perceived lack of games that affect the 3DS at this point, the largest one being the price. You see, they priced out a premium product in a non-premium market. Nintendo owners or Nintendo gamers or Nintendo customers are not crazy fanatical idiots like Apple customers. They're not people who are going to jump up and down over the latest iPad. Which, by the way, the most popular selling iPads are not the expensive models. Those are the ones that lag. Those are the lagging performers, which is evident of a bad market. We're in a down economy, and, well, let's see. America's going through what happened with Japan, where Japan actually has, and still is in, a recession after they had a bubble market during the 80s and early 90s. And, it just means that, sigh, times are tough. And Nintendo priced stuff expecting the market to recover quicker than it has. And it hasn't really recovered to begin with. So this price cut isn't an admission of defeat. It's an admission of devotion. In other words, it shows, along with the pay cuts, that Nintendo is devoted to providing the 3DS with a reasonable chance at developing market share. Right now, the 3DS is a bit expensive. However, after August 12th, which is my birthday, by the way, after August 12th, the Nintendo 3DS will be cheaper than the cheapest iPod Touch and will contain much better games. The Game Boy Advance games that came out, that they announced for the Ambassador Program, are interesting. One of them is Wear Mega Micro Games, which actually I'm looking forward to seeing on that. That's going to be pretty great. All things considered, if you bring up that one, just that one right there, play through that one. It's kind of a... If you ever wanted to play everything that was on the Apple iOS store, play WarioWare Mega Micro Games. That's all that iOS games really are just rip-offs of the little tiny micro games that you see in WarioWare. Oh, I said something controversial. Okay, let's go back to... Let's see if there's any other news. Well, there actually really isn't. We're going to be uploading the download guide, of course, on Thursday, and we'll find out what's being released for that. However, we do know that in Japan, the NES version of TwinBee, is being released as a 3D classic. So that makes Xevious, Excitebike, Urban Champion, and TwinBee. Interesting. We'll see what else is added to that later on. Looking forward to seeing it, though. That's going to be quite interesting. There isn't really too much in the newsity for this. It's all been about this big price drop that Nintendo took. Now, somewhere along the way, though, there was a rumor that the PlayStation Vita would be released in October. However, in order to be released in October, they would actually have to show off a final production model of that unit, which they have not shown off yet. And they would have to have gotten orders into Foxconn, the people who put together PlayStation or 3DS products and stuff like Nintendo products and stuff, by 2 months ago. So I do not think that the PlayStation Vita, as rumored, is going to hit in October 28th unless they've been really good at hiding it. That said, there's been a few interesting rumors going around that the unit will be pushed into March of next year for the PlayStation Vita, which gives Nintendo a very comfortable Christmas. I expect to see the red version of the Nintendo 3DS, which actually debuts very soon in Japan, to make its debut this holiday season in the United States of America. And kind of stealthily, within this announcement, they announced a November release for Super Mario 3D Land, which means that Super Mario 3D Land and that Pokemon game, the Rumble one, are coming out in the same month, which is good. And then Mario Kart 7, which they decided not to give any weird fancy names. They're just calling it 7. And then Kid Icarus will be coming around the same time as well. So let's see. Let's tag that in with Cave Story coming out. We'll probably have Resident Evil Revelations in January or February of next year. We've got a couple more things coming out for that it's going to be a pretty good it's going to be a pretty good fall and holiday season for the Nintendo 3DS and Nintendo DS fans. Don't forget, we also have a Professor Layton and Professor Layton and the Last Spectre. Yeah, the Last Spectre coming out. And that's also compatible with 3DS as well as, apparently, NES Classics, which they kind of stealthily announced with this. Overall, I think it's going to be pretty good. And I have to applaud Nintendo on this because it's a interesting proposition to drop the price of something four months after it's been released. Now, they didn't have to put out an ambassador program or give people anything for it, and I'm kind of glad they went ahead and did that. I mean, Sony lost all of our personal information, and it ended up on 4chan. And what did they do? They're like, hey, guess what? There's a couple games that came out a couple years ago that you might already have, and let's go ahead and put these out. Now, with the Nintendo Game Boy Advance and NES things, go to a GameStop and try and find a Game Boy Advance. They're getting harder and harder to find, and some of these games are more and more expensive for it. Remember, some used marketplaces will still sell games like Super Princess Peach for the DS, of all things, for like $40. So yeah, Nintendo giving out Game Boy Advance games and NES games is a good deal. I know there's people who are like, but I got these on my Wii. Who cares? Try cramming your Wii and a TV into your pocket everywhere you go. Then, whatever. It's not feasible to do that. So, hey, Nintendo's giving you these for free. And you're looking a gift horse in the mouth at this point. And if you ask me, that makes you look really, really picky, finicky, and stupid. Okay? And I'm talking specifically about certain people at a certain website, which I'm not going to plug anymore, Nintendojo. Huh. Seriously. The amount of negativity coming from some Nintendo fans, quote-unquote, is really kind of distressing. And it occurs to me that these people are just being cynical and negative because they want to be. They don't have any real good excuse to. Maybe they're making up for something, some type of inadequacy. But you know what? The only thing that you have to worry about that's in your pants right now is a Nintendo 3DS. And if you're not having fun with that, then hey, that's your deal. That said, let's get into a little bit about the feature that we have in tonight's program. You see, today we're going to be putting up the interview we did with Monty Ewum at ACON 22 2011. Now, because he put together the Dead Fantasy series, which is a series of fan videos where Final Fantasy characters fight characters from Dead or Alive. In a way, this is the last in the trilogy, or rather trifecta, of Dead or Alive-related content that we got from ACON. That trifecta, including Vanessa V. Ortega and the members of Team Ninja themselves. So, enjoy this part of the trifecta. This is the Triforce of it. I guess you could say Vanessa would be the Triforce of Courage. Team Ninja would be the Triforce of Wisdom. And Monty Ewum would be the Triforce of Power. I mean, animation is his kung fu. Not to spoil anything from that. Now, I do have a confession about this particular interview. After I did the interview, sometimes I'll do an interview and I feel that I could have asked better questions, or it could have been better. Then listening through this one again, I realized, hey, I asked B-grade questions and Monty Ewum gave me AAA answers. Going back to a few other interviews that I've done, I realize, wow, even though sometimes I might not feel it might be the most interesting thing, listening back to it, I'm completely wrong a lot of times on this. These are some awesome interviews, and you guys are lucky to be hearing them. They're great. Anyways, I'm looking forward to Denver Comic Con next year and Non-DeskCon this September. Oh, there are some great interviews that we could possibly get there. And then, of course, Anime Land Wasabi and such. I do have an interesting little story I should relate. I do feel that part of an interviewer's job is not to make the guest interesting, because that's really up to the questions that are asked or how you read your guest. The whole point of a conversation, or rather an interview, is to converse. I think, it was after the Monty Ewum interview, he told me that it felt like he'd been at a job interview, which, actually, this is kind of how they should be conducted. You see, an interview is a conversation with me and you, and I'm trying to get information or interesting things about you, little things that come up, and my radio experience before this actually had to do with two kind of failing shows. One was Green Rights Radio. That was on 101.5 FM The Truth here in Denver, Colorado. And then the other one is a little after that. I worked a little bit with Marijuana Radio, which I think they're still on iTunes. Now, both of those are actually fairly negative. I remember bringing in... I used to schedule some of the guests for Green Rights Radio, and I scheduled... One of the people I scheduled was the inventor of something called the Chill Clock. We have a thing on an unboxing for that on our Area DMG YouTube channel. Now, I talked to that guy for a good almost 45 minutes on the phone, and before I was able to get him on there to interview that, and I wrote down a series of questions that I got some great answers for from him. Handed those off to the host of Green Rights Radio, and he was just like, nah, I'm not going to ask these. Then after he got maybe a 10-minute interview out of that, later on, during commercial break, he's like, don't ever get me a guest like that again. I couldn't get anything out of them. And I'm sitting here thinking to myself, how is it that by actually conducting a conversation in the way you conduct a conversation, I got 45 minutes out of this guy on the phone, and you couldn't get 10 minutes out of that? I feel that too many interviewers look at stuff like that and think, eh. And in a way, I am guilty of that sometimes. Like when we went into our Lynn Hardy interview, I wasn't sure it was going to be as interesting as it ended up being. That actually was pretty decent. And the Monty Ewum one, I wasn't so sure either. But it turned out okay. It turned out great, actually. And I'm glad and honored to be able to share it with you. So I think that you need to sit back, relax, and enjoy our feature presentation, which is an interview with Monty Ewum of Dead Fantasy, or Haloid fame. He also works with Rooster Teeth, and he's also worked for some interesting companies, which you'll find out in the course of our interview. So enjoy this part of our holy trifecta of dead or alive content. It adds a new dimension to it. Also, there's a little bit of mention of Tekken in here too, so hey, it all ties back. So enjoy our feature, and thank you for listening to Radio DMG. We'll be right back after this, your feature presentation. Our interview with Monty Uwam from Akon 22, 2011.
And welcome back to Radio DMG. I'm your host, Philip Wesley, and I'm here with...
Monty Uwam.
And we're here over at Akon 22. And let's go ahead and start up with a... Well, you're a bit of an internet famous person because of the Dead Fantasy series, right?
Yes.
Just in case our listeners aren't up to speed on it, explain Dead Fantasy in your words.
Dead Fantasy is a fan film that I started a few years ago, where it consists of Dead or Alive characters versus Final Fantasy characters.
Hmm.
Yep.
And then you made a little spin-off with Halo and Metroid, right?
Yes. In fact, an earlier film, which kind of was my launching pad, was Halo versus Metroid, which had a Halo Spartan versus Samus from Metroid.
Hmm. And currently you're working with Rooster Teeth?
That's right. I work with Rooster Teeth Productions, which are predominantly known for the Red versus Blue series.
Mm-hmm. So, what got you started into CGI?
I guess there's two ways to answer that question. Like, the easy answer is, 6 years ago, I opened up a program and just started fiddling with it. The long answer is 29 years, because I've always been interested in filmmaking, and it just happened to be my route to it. I was always interested in, you know, virtual production. I mean, even when I was playing video games, when they first started becoming 3D, I could see the polygons and the lines before I saw the game, and I would always like analyze motion data and how often they were used and how often they were reused in games. And my animation model is actually kind of built off of video games and having played them my whole life.
Mm. So what was the first program that you used for 3D animation?
The first program is still the program I currently use, which is Poser, which some people are surprised to hear because it's not the most well-regarded 3D program when you can consider the industry standard Max and Maya that are used by most animation houses. And I explain this in saying that Poser's not a great program, but I don't need a great program because when you consider the depths of the industry standard 3D programs, I'd rather know everything about something small than a little bit of something big. And that's why I can make films, because I don't consider myself an animator. I consider myself a filmmaker, and every time I have a discussion about this, I call it 3D filmmaking, not 3D animation, because it's not about being a good animator. Animators work for guys with the vision. I want to be the guy with the vision. And it very often, in a film production, the director is the one who dictates the actions of pretty much technological tools, animators themselves even being considered a tool for production, but not the actual vision or of the production itself. Since I have to do it all, I consider the scope of what I do 3D filmmaking, which is delivered through animation.
Do you storyboard at all when you're going into these? Like, how do you plan out your productions?
I have a version of storyboarding which isn't storyboarding at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like the same way you'd do an AMV, where I listen to the song that I'd make a movie to, and this is strictly because, one, I have a history in dance, and I like rhythmic timing. In fact, combat, even in movies that don't directly put it forward as a rhythmic combat, tend to put their sound design as rhythmic, because the human mind naturally accepts rhythm. So when you hear a combo that's a 1-2-3 and it sounds naturally acceptable to the mind because it has a sense of rhythm, the mind naturally accepts rhythm. Also because, just out of necessity, when I started making these movies, I had real jobs. On top of that, you can't always be at your desk. Even though I'm at my desk maybe 90% of my day, I plan to movies so that I can. I plan my movies to music so that I can pre-visualize anywhere in the world. Like I'd be waiting in line at the airport, and I could listen to the song, and I'd visualize to the beats and plan a movie accordingly. So like when I was making Haloid, I had the same song playing over and over on my 1 hour commute to work, and I would hear a trumpet to a punch or a violin to a slide. And that's how I kind of visualize my movies.
So you said you had a history with dance. Did you start in like modern dance or?
My history in dance was I started playing DDR when I moved to California.
Oh, okay.
But I don't.
You know, I was professional.
No. I mean, I did dance in circles and among people, but never. I'm not professionally schooled by any means, which is another question that I get often. I have my own method. I've had thus far. This is why it's a 29-year answer. I've had my own methods for discovering everything I do. I'm a high school dropout. When I studied dance, I discovered DDR, and then I realized I like dancing, so then I just started dancing in general. When I picked up 3D programs, it's because it was what was on the computer that I happened to get donated to me at the time. In fact, I just had a panel where I explained the first computers I got were computers I fished out of dumpsters. Ooh. And they happened to have certain programs on them. So like the first computer I got was a Mac 2 that I'd used in a school I'd gone to. And when they were upgrading to their Mac Pluses, I waited out behind the school for them to throw them out, and I just took as many computers home as I could with me. So back when I started with two colors, black and white, and Mac Paint and HyperCard, running off of a 3.5-inch disc that I had to swap out for different programs.
That's always great. The old good old days, the 3.5 and the 5.5. Oh yeah, that you could like put a notch on the side, make it double sided.
That's right.
So today, I'm pretty sure you're not using those old Mac 2s.
No.
What are you using today?
Today, I'm actually predominantly a PC process. Also, because of having recently joined Rooster Teeth, they have a very good model of buy whatever software or hardware is necessary. So I have motion capture available to me now. I've come a pretty long way from black and white on Mac 2 to some fairly high-end PCs with thousands of dollars worth of motion capture and computer equipment. So, like, currently, I do my movies with myself performing the motion capture. And, in fact, the motion capture volume is also my desk. And I spend a lot of my days wearing a motion capture suit all day. And whenever I need data, I just get up and perform it.
One thing I've noticed about, like, a lot of motion capture stuff, that stuff looks a little fragile, is it?
Fragile for the equipment?
Like the equipment, the suits and stuff, like the little bulbs and such. They look like you might fall and they'll break.
Not so much. Motion capture essentially is a spectrum of infrared that's triangulated through multiple cameras. So if I ever fall and break the dots, I just pull out another set of dots and attach them to my body. Falling on the dots isn't fun because it's like having a marble shoved into you.
yeah, I'm pretty sure.
And then there's the fact that I'm wearing a spandex Velcro suit. You know, all hours of the day, which you just have to commit to. But the motion capture technology itself, it's not so sensitive that, you know, I'd break it. The cameras, I obviously wouldn't want to fall on the floor, but they're mounted very sturdily. The suits themselves are fairly primitive. It's just Velcro and infrared reflectors, which is just essentially like same level of spectrum of like having duct tape balls wrapped to your body.
Since you've used a normal CG, and you've also used motion capture. Have you tried rotoscoping? Where like the live action rotoscoping that they do in say Waking Life or through a Scanner Darkly or Renaissance.
I have done some type of there's various levels of rotoscoping. Sometimes rotoscoping could be even considered animation reference. Like in previous movies where I was animating by hand, sometimes I'd want to do a very specific move. If it was say maybe a trick or move that I saw a certain martial artist perform, like I'd get that YouTube video, place it in the background, and then animate the character over that person. Or maybe even if it was a move from a fighting game that I've done in certain episodes of Dead Fantasy, I would take that move and then animate the character over that, and maybe even augment it. But that would be the level of rotoscoping I've used. Never direct translation of film or anything like that, but sometimes just for the sake of paying homage to a certain move.
Ah, you were talking about the rhythm of fighting that you see in movies and such. What particular fighting movies have you seen that you feel had a very rhythmic battle? In other words, which martial arts or action films inspire you?
I mean, all of us who grew up watching kung fu movies throughout the 90s, like watched like Fist of Legend or Iron Monkey or the Once Upon a Time in China series. I mean, we're all of that age now where we were back then when we were renting these videos from Blockbuster or animes for that matter. I mean, I get inspiration from all directions sometimes, but a lot of those, I find like the Matrix movies have a good sense of rhythm to them because they're guys like me. They were just fans of the stuff we all grew up watching, and they landed at a point in their careers where they just got to make them. I'm kind of nearing that point in my life, too, where I could just make whatever I want, so I'm just going to make the stuff that I like and I grew up liking. And there's a lot of it, you know. Just named a few, so.
Just a few.
Yeah.
Yeah. Going into your history, it says you've worked at Midway.
Yep.
What did you do at Midway?
When I made Haloid, in the storm of press that followed, I got contacted by one of the directors at Midway Games, and the initial reaction to that is you think, you know, they saw my animation, so obviously they'd want to hire me as an animator. But since I use non-standard software, again, I don't use industry standard software, I couldn't be an animator because I don't use Max or Maya, but that wasn't important. They hired me more on concept rather than technical execution. So I was hired at Midway as a combat designer, which is essentially the guy who says, I want this move to look like this. And then you tell an animator to animate it, which, I mean, that's the job of a combat designer, is to come up with the cool move, not to actually execute it.
So did you get to work on any of the Mortal Kombat games that Midway has?
Actually, I worked on a... unnamed, unreleased currently project, which I'm still under NDA to not talk about because, you know, Midway reached some financial crisis and they had somewhat of an exodus, but there's still a chance this could get made, which would be great. So if it ever gets made, then I can talk about it. Yeah.
That's the tricky thing with these NDAs. Since you are working with Rooster Teeth on some of their series, you're working on Red versus Blue, and what's their one with the Sims? Are you working on that one?
No.
Okay,
that Sims one lasted a season and was done for quite some time. But the Red versus Blue is well enough work to take up all my time. So I'm currently working on season 9. We finished up season 8 last year. I'm actually working on season 9 right now, and will be as soon as I get back, because it has a lot of predominantly action-oriented CG scenes with new characters who more or less fit the scope of what my work involves. Last season, we had a lot of the debate on how much CG to use based on the motivation of characters. So this season, we conveniently wrote it around the idea of having characters that more fit my work. Yeah.
So are you going to be using any models from, say, Halo 4, since that was announced, or the Halo Special Edition?
We have a close relation with Microsoft, but we also are very much into doing our own thing. they're very happy with the amount of work we do, and I mean integrating Halo 4 at this point, considering it's not even out yet, would be kind of hard. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of potential for our projects together in the future. I'm not even certain what's going on because I only heard about Halo 4 just at about the same time everyone else did.
That and the Halo Collector's Edition.
The new Halo Collector's Edition.
They spice up the first one.
That's right.
Would be kind of interesting if they go back and decide to spice up some of the original seasons.
That would be cool. But, I mean, when you think about, we have a team of only about 16 people. And as far as the Red versus Blue team goes, it's me and three other guys. So if you had to choose between remakes of the old stuff or kick-ass new stuff, I'd choose the kick-ass new stuff.
Oh, of course.
Yeah. So that's where we kind of land on that situation.
Are you looking to do any more Dead Fantasy, or are you still continuing that series?
Oh, yeah. I actually had a panel last night where I showed some new footage. It's difficult because as a hobby project, it's something I have to do on the side. And as a nonprofit project, to avoid any IP collisions and stuff, I do it in off time for absolutely no money. So it's not hard to find motivation, but it's hard to find time for when I have to prioritize my day job, which already takes up enough of my time. I work every day of the week, every hour I can, and I'm at the studio every hour I'm not asleep. And when I am asleep, I'm at my apartment, which is across the street from our studio, and I still drive to work. So I have a 1 minute commute to my work, and that's how fast I need to get to my desk. So there's simply not enough hours in the day for me to work on Dead Fantasy, which is the current problem. But as soon as I finish this DVD, I'll get some done, And there's an, you know, it's never say never. It's only a matter of time. But, you know, the problem with that is people want more, and they don't see that. Or they don't see the person who has to, you know, pay his bills. So
yeah.
Yeah, it's tough.
So have you gotten any feedback from Tecmo concerning Dead Fantasy or Square Enix?
I actually met up with Tecmo this weekend. Mm-hmm. They like the work I do. I mean, you can also consider it free advertising. I actually had a conversation with one of their reps, and it was about, I actually don't think there was a DOA wiki, like a fan wiki about the characters. You know how often there's a wiki for IPs.
Yeah.
I don't think there was a DOA wiki before Dead Fantasy. I think my work garnered interest from Final Fantasy fans to build the DOA wiki and like explore the history of the characters. I mean, don't quote me on that, but maybe it could be attributed to my work helping expand their publicity. As far as Square goes, same deal. It's not something, you know, they can acknowledge, but it's something they like. Again, it's all completely for non-profit. I do it strictly for fun as a fan project, and it'll always be that way, which, again, makes it hard to do.
So why the Dead or Alive and Final Fantasy series and not, say, Tekken or Virtua Fighter or some of the other ones that are out there?
I'm actually more of a... I mean, I've been playing Dead or Alive since Dead or Alive 1 was in the arcade, and I'm a big fan of the series, but I've played Tekken for much longer and much more time. And I'm much more of a Tekken fan. But I feel like Dead or Alive complements Final Fantasy more because, for one, they have a predominantly ninja cast. And Final Fantasy has this huge history of characters I can draw from and this, you know, this entire library of magics and skills and abilities for every character. So I have plenty of inspiration to work off from there. Whereas Ninja Gaiden and Dead or Alive, they have a predominantly ninja cast and even their own set of powers and stuff that they're expanding on even till this point with the new Ninja Gaiden and new Dead or Alive. But I can also just take the whole history of ninja games, animes, and movies and always just reference that if I ever need a new move. And that's kind of like almost the history in itself, which the reason they complement each other is because the characters have a sense of parallel. And just like in Halo versus Metroid, I feel like the most important thing is honoring the characters and making sure the characters I put against each other complement each other in a way.
Hmm.
Yes.
So the design of the characters.
Design, motivation, history, like everything about them. Like it's helpful that I'm a fan of both games and I understand their characters and their backstories, so I can always reference to what they would do in a scene. And to me, you can't just animate a scene. You have to animate it based on what they would do and how they would react. So I often, you know, I don't create the classes. I interpret like a class of fighter or character that they would be in for each fight and every role in the story, and I try to fill out those roles accordingly. So it's important, like, the reason I match up certain people against other certain people is because I feel like they, as a class, complements each other, and then as a whole, this whole cast of one side versus another complements each other.
So, since we're on the subject of video games there, you're talking about playing Dead or Alive in the arcades. Mm-hmm. Do you remember what first introduced you to video games?
I think I've always been interested. I mean, I played Street Fighter 1. In the arcade, like as far as I can remember, going to the arcade, and I've probably been going to the arcade since I was like 4 years old. As soon as I could go, I come from a large family, so they, you know, my older brothers would go to arcades first, and they'd string me along, and I'd watch them play, and then eventually I'd get to play myself. So I can't actually remember the first games I played. It might have been like Contra or Raiden. The top-down shooter. It might have even been more primitive than that if I think about it hard enough. I can't even remember. Mm. Yeah.
Do you own any of the modern video game consoles?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I work at a game-based company. The problem now isn't the ability to get games, it's the time to play them.
Ah, yeah.
Considering my work schedule and the amount, I mean, I used to play games, furiously, like sometimes just try to find different ways to play the same game over and over. Now I can barely find time to play a game. I very often just watch them on YouTube just to get the experience, which is kind of sad in a way, but at least I can have an avenue. I watched 400 Persona 4 videos in a playlist at one point.
Was that the giant bomb one or something?
No. It was like someone's playlist on YouTube who actually went through the whole game and every branch of conversation. And I've got my experience for Persona through that.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a lot of videos.
There are some people, you know?
Yeah.
But going into those, like you've mentioned that you don't like to call it animation, more like 3D film direction.
Yep.
Is there any animation that that you find inspires it, aside from like the general anime like Naruto or Ninja Scroll or Rurouni Kenshin, Bleach?
Yeah, I mean, I watch a lot of those general animes, and I feel like they all have there's a general aesthetic that animes have established that just works. And works for the reason that it's what's good, but when you translate that into 3D, you have to add a layer onto it that makes it more believable because the shading is better. So it's a level of art style that works for anime, but would look a little more stunted in 3D animation. So I try to find that middle ground of anime video game cinematic. A lot of video game cinematics I watch, you know, have that established version of. They also like that anime style, but need to also do the higher fidelity version. And then even higher than that is the movie version, which honestly I think Hollywood itself is catching up with the anime style at this point and are trying to find that interpretation. Recent movies like Sucker Punch tried to do the anime version in live action and are finding their feet in it. If I ever land in that position, I feel like because of the body of work and the history I'm doing, that I could probably make that movie too. I think after watching Sucker Punch, I think I could have found a better way to make that movie.
After watching too that one and Skyline, there's so many better ways they could have been done.
Yep. Yeah.
Absolutely. So since you've been busy with Rooster Teeth, and what was your previous work at Namco?
Namco. About a year after my job, I was into my job at Midway. While I was at Midway, we were in the pre-planning for our game. And in my off time, whenever I could find it, I started the Dead Fantasy series. I mean, I like Halo, and I did Halo as a fan project to kind of gain some publicity, also to make a good product. But I really like Japanese games, fighting games, and Final Fantasy. So I'm like, I'll make the one that is for me and my fans. Well, not fans I didn't even have yet at the time. Me and people who like the same stuff I do. So because I make a Final Fantasy movie, I now have met, you know, dozens of people that I would honestly have already been friends with had not been, we lived on other sides of the country or other sides of the planet. So the point of making Dead Fantasy was, it's the movie for, I mean, I almost consider it not something that doesn't completely belong to me as a fan project. It belongs to everyone who likes these IPs. The reason for making it is because everyone loves it. And I go to cons now, I get invited to ACON especially, and I have a panel where 200 people show up to see the next one, to see my version of it. So I made Dead Fantasy while I was at Midway, and then I made Dead Fantasy 2 shortly after that. And the art director at Namco Games contacted me and wanted me to join them to work on the Afro Samurai game. And I had trouble making the decision first because, one, I just started at Namco, and I just moved to Chicago to work on their game, to Midway.
Midway, yeah.
To work on their game. And it just gotten used to their system, but then Namco was telling me to come work with them and finish their game. So I said yes to that, and I moved to Northern California, San Jose studio, and worked on Afro Samurai, the game, which starting off I couldn't get my head around the system, but eventually I started getting very good at it, and then eventually I was the best at it. It's just the kind of the way I do things is you can't do anything unless you're going to be the absolute best. And so when I joined also Namco as a designer, combat designer, not an animator, but I was learning animation at the same time to learn these standard programs, Maya. And when I joined Namco and I rose in the ranks as a designer at Namco, I started off on low level characters, giants and like some ninja types and maybe Ronin types, and then eventually worked my way up to, I started taking up boss characters that were said to be cut, and I was like, let me do it. And when you save a boss character from being cut from the game just for the fact that no one else had an idea of what to make of this character, and I did, that's when people started realizing that I was the one to work on the next project. So by the end of the project, I had been promoted to lead combat designer. And the only misfortune here was that I had joined Namco maybe 6 months too late, because, you know, as we didn't get approved for a sequel, and I was as people were leaving the company because, you know, we had no title to work on. People were saying, if only I had joined the company 6 months earlier, this game would have been a completely different, you know, shape. So, you know, that's what prompted me to contact Rooster Teeth, who had contacted me well before, years earlier, after Haloid, and talked about working with me. I kind of had to go do this game designer process to work at these large corporate companies to realize maybe I should work at a more closely knit independent company and not have 200 other people decide whether or not I could even do the good work that I was doing. So, like, working on a large team at Namco, no matter how good a job I did, that didn't ultimately decide the fate of our product. So that's why Rooster Teeth is so much a better fit for me.
Since your original film made a lot of waves on social media, nowadays it's really easy for someone to publish something on YouTube and get a lot of views. When you first put this out, I don't think YouTube was as popular.
Yeah, I don't think it would happen again if I did this. I did the exact same thing today.
Mm-hmm. How did you get it out?
Well, actually, I didn't even put it on YouTube at first. I put it on Game Trailers, and till this day, it's still the most viewed video on GameTrailers.com. 4 million views, which sounds like a lot, but then you consider the 30 million view videos on YouTube. Maybe that's why. The bar is really high these days. A lot of talented people out there. I say it isn't about, and the thing that people notice is it's not about, well, I mean, the views are a part of it, but it's not about good as much as it is about unique. And I think part of what I delivered in terms of both storytelling and concept is just this unique storm of unique combination of talents and, you know, ideas and such that is what people notice, because we see talent every day, and then you get into this, it's almost like the Olympics now on YouTube, where you just, people are outdoing each other every day. I use an analogy very often, and I describe it, Bruce Lee. Bruce Lee, among certain circles, is considered the best martial artist in the world. Among other circles, who are maybe even more martial arts informed, say Bruce Lee was a hack, and he just screamed a lot and flexed in front of the camera, and was only popular because he was the first to bring it. But I think it's partly both right, because he was the first to bring a unique set of ideas to a new world, which has value in itself. And even back in his time, when he had students that trained under him, they would come up to him and say, "Bruce Lee, I will never be as good as you because I can't kick as high as you." And his answer to that is, "Just kick mid better than me." And what he's trying to tell people is, it's not about doing the best. Like, you kicking high the best doesn't make you the best martial artist, nor was kicking mid. It's about finding your own unique combination of what you bring forward and present to people. And he was much a philosopher about this. My inspiration off of that is, I can't kick as high as Bruce Lee. I can't even kick mid as good as Bruce Lee, but I can sure as hell animate better than Bruce Lee. So in my way, it's like, animation is my kung fu. So, like, I'm just a better combination of that than Bruce Lee ever will be. And very often, and I get often asked about, like, how do you even obtain a level of, you know, this sort of thing where you can make these sort of things. It's not about, like, the people who say, I want to study animation to be you. It's not about being me or even, you know, becoming an animator. You should just surpass me in your own way. And it's not about being the best, or, you know, it's about surpassing the best. And it's a silly thing to say, but I surpass Bruce Lee as an animator because it's just, he never thought about it, you know, that route, but it's, that's the way to look at it. And when you consider just humanity as a whole, it's like, there's so many routes to take towards success. And, you know, how often do you get into a fight? I animate fights every day, you know?
No.
Yeah.
Going in, so have you used motion capture data other than yourself for your work?
Occasionally, but I found it easier just to be the one to get up every day and say, I need data, I'm going to capture it right now, versus this is what I learned from having worked at corporate jobs. When you work with multiple people, they all have their own schedules. I mean, going from one person to two people is already a step up in terms of scheduling. Going from one people to like five people is an impossibility, and collaborations are just downright difficult. So my answer always was just to get good at everything I can. So that part of that became get good at performing motion capture, and it just helps that I have a history in motion. So I mean, I would get up and perform moves just for to reference myself anyways in the past. Now, instead of capturing, which occasionally I'll capture other people, especially if it's a grappling maneuver, and I obviously can't grab myself at the same time. But very often, in you see in my movies, in the current season we're even working on, every character is getting played by me. And I just have to study or augment the performance as much as possible and be as varied at times. So even the music videos where it's nine girls dancing, that just happens to be me dancing on stage, kind of something that throws people off. But yeah, I do all the motion because it's the most convenient answer. Hmm. Yeah.
So when you decided to drop out of high school, did you go and get a GED or is it a...
Well, when I dropped out of high school, it's because, I mean, I've always wanted to make movies. And back then I didn't know it would be through this route of 3D animation. Mm-hmm. You know, when you think about making movies back then, it was, I guess I need to be an actor, you know, find that route. So I moved to New York, and dropping out of high school wasn't, you know, I want to drop out of high school and, you know, go make movies. It's dropping out of high school because I wasn't a very good student. I just never had good grades. And the solution was, look, this just isn't working, and I'm going to find another way out. And it obviously wasn't the best idea, and I wouldn't recommend it to anyone else. I just happened to, when I dropped out of high school, I'd always been studying programs, and it only became useful 10 years later. So
more self-taught, really.
Yeah. Yes. I never went to college for these programs. I just always used them.
You just picked it up and thought, well, I'm going to do this today.
Yeah.
And a lot of people think that go into these things, they get daunted, I guess you could say, by the complexity of many of these programs, even some of the simplest programs. What would you suggest people do when approaching these difficult programs? Like, just do it?
I totally understand that daunting feeling because, I mean, when Midway contacted me to be a designer, I had no idea what I was in for. And for the longest time, I felt like, I even said once, which got laughs, it's like, I think I'm too old to learn this stuff. And I was 26 at the time. Too old is a joke. But I just felt like this, I still was under the assumption this is the sort of thing you learned in school. But just given enough time, I learned it. I got past it. And which was why it was a hard decision to leave Midway after having learned this stuff, because then I would be leaving to learn yet another system. And so again, I was under this series of daunting tasks of learning a new animation design system for building characters in the Afro Engine. And actually, it was kind of tough even leaving that behind. But, you know, when someone says you can't use this engine to make this game anymore, you kind of have to figure out a different route. But that daunting feeling is natural, especially with these programs. I mean, I started learning how to animate in Maya when I was at Namco, and that was daunting. But you just do it a little bit at a time and just power through it. It's always going to be hard, but it's always worth it.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Now, you've been to several conventions, including ACON. What's your best and worst convention experience?
Well, my best and worst might be the same one. Hmm. Not to say anything bad about the con itself, but just the way events turned out. Like, the best experience I've ever had at con was Anime Boston, when I premiered Dead Fantasy for the first time in front of a crowd of 5,000 people. They had learned, I premiered Haloid at the same con a year prior, but it was after the AMVs, which is kind of the rule because it's not necessarily an AMV, which I'm perfectly fine with. It's more about people seeing it than it is competing. But in 2007, Haloid played after the AMVs, and people were already done and getting out of their seats, and half the room was kind of empty while Haloid started playing. It's just something we couldn't anticipate. But what was really cool is the next year, Dead Fantasy was playing in front of the same audience, 5,000 people packed into a room who had no idea this was coming. And they got up in the PA and just were like, no one leave. There is something really cool coming, and you have to watch this. And so the best moment, not just at a con, one of the best moments of my life ever was when Dead Fantasy... one was already out, but I premiered one and two, and not many people had seen either. And this was two for the first time anywhere. Dead Fantasy 1 and 2 played in front of an audience of 5,000 people, and I was sitting among the audience. And just it's so exhilarating to have just 5,000 people screaming over your movie. And that would be the best experience ever in anything, con or not. But it also it becomes hard when, like, organization is tough, and I, you know, who can say no to more of that? And that same event happened the next day. Like, they premiered it on a Friday night, and then they just impromptu, one of their Saturday concerts were running late, and they showed it again. And I wish they had told me, because, you know, my girlfriend was there with me, and she could have been there with me when this next set of 5,000 people were screaming over the work I had done, but no one told me. And we were in the next room because the concert ran late. Let's show Dead Fantasy. And people loved it. And I was just wandering around the con with my girlfriend, just like, what to do. And I found out later, oh, you guys showed the movie. I wish you'd told me, which is kind of disappointing. So, yeah, that would be the disappointing part of that story. And it was the same weekend. Yeah.
So both best and worst.
Best and worst in the same weekend, yeah.
So one thing about anime conventions that I've noticed is you get a lot of people who get here, they're screaming, there's yelling, there's lots of energy. People are really hyped up at the conventions. But when they leave the conventions, they become really shy and reserved and kind of withdrawn. Any suggestions or tips on how they can be a little bit more of that take that energy from inside the convention and bring it into their daily life to be a little bit more outgoing?
Well, I find often that people are better in their natural element. It just so happens that the natural element here is anime and anime culture, which in itself is spreading more than it ever was. So, in a way, I feel like it's already happening, that people get to naturally, like the other day I was at the hairdresser before an event, and, you know, a hairdresser, I don't expect her to know anything about anime or anything about cosplay. And the conversation just happens to lean towards design and costume making. And then I find out that she loves cosplay and that she loves, I no idea. She looks none to be this type, but, you know, no assumptions. I mean, this could be anywhere now. And it's, I guess the best changes are the ones that happen gradually. So let's not say everyone should just take their con attitude and walk out the door with it, because then you're just going to kind of, you know,
scare people,
yeah. But just a little. Just keep doing it, and it'll just get bigger on its own. It might not happen within our lifetime. Well, maybe it will. Or within this generation of con goers, but the cons themselves have gotten bigger and bigger. Acon, I discovered, wow, in its 22nd year? That's quite insane. So, you know, in for the long run, and then more cons just start showing up after that. Yeah.
So, what conventions are you going to after Acon this year?
Well, considering my schedule, I'm making time for one more con. That's Anime Expo, because, you know, on top of being, you know, just abhorrently busy, I also just feel like making another costume for my girlfriend, and why not go to the biggest con to celebrate that? So let's do that. I don't have another video, unfortunately, but maybe next time. But at least for a bit of time off during the summer, my girlfriend and I are going to go to Anime Expo and just have fun with the people we've met there thus far. No events, though. I'm not making any announcements about that.
Yeah. Oh, any word yet on when we can expect season 9 of Red vs. Blue?
Well, Red vs. Blue is actually starting to air next week.
Next week?
Episode 1 on June 14th.
Excellent.
And what we've got at this point is a train in which we're laying the tracks down right in front of it as it goes forward. So as soon as I'm done here, I have to go back to my studio and throw on the suit and animate the latter half of this movie. As we start airing it, it's quite daunting. But hey, I mean, that's kind of been the theme of my life, these impossible tasks that I just have to get done.
It's like, just hit the ground running, right?
Yes, exactly.
And we have to hit the ground running, too. So I guess we can go ahead. What final message would you like to give our studio audience?
I guess it would be just do what you're good at. And it's always useful, ultimately. A lot about my panel was I had no direction in my life, but it all became useful in the end. And just because it doesn't pay off immediately doesn't mean it won't pay off in the end, or, you know, ultimately. Because 12 years after, not even 20 years after the stuff I was kind of interested in the past started becoming useful. And, you know, don't let stuff being daunting about technology, you know, throw you off. It could be any method of things. I mean, I'm starting to explore the idea of using miniatures in 3D movies just to blur that line between what exactly is the definition of something. So the overall message is just learn to think more laterally. Be divergent. It's divergent thinking is the idea. It's question how things have been done. That doesn't mean they always have to be done that way.
Hmm. Yeah. Oh, and where can people catch Dead Fantasy or Haloid?
They're predominantly on game trailers. I also have a YouTube channel, which is quite consolidated for Dead Fantasy especially. Mm. Haloid is currently, a quick Google search to my name will throw all of this up on in the results, but Haloid itself, it's primarily hosted on game trailers as well as Dead Fantasy. I have a YouTube account, YouTube.com/MontyUm. My recent work at Red vs. Blue can be seen at Red vs. Blue or roosterteeth.com. And season 9 will start airing next Tuesday.
Okay. And that's online?
That's online.
That's online.
Yep.
Okay. No problem. All well, right. this is your host, Philip Wesley, and our guest today,
MontyUm.
And we're going to wish you a good night.
Thank you.
And that was our interview with MontyUm from Akon 22. I am your host, Philip Wesley, the Mile High Mouth, for Radio DMG, episode 17. And thank you for listening, and good night.